Well, turn with me again then, please, to the 23rd Psalm. Now, the church where I grew up, being situated where it is in rural North Yorkshire, tends to attract a fair number of Christian holidaymakers. And on one occasion, perhaps 20 years ago now, there was an American couple that came along to the church, and my parents invited them over to the house, and we had a very pleasant time with them. They were from Sun Valley in California, and for many years they had been members of Grace Community Church there, where John MacArthur is the pastor. And anyway, as they were leaving our house after spending an evening with us, my dad remarked somewhat naively, I suppose, "Send our greetings to your pastor." At which point these Americans looked at him in disbelief. "What, Dr. MacArthur?" they said. "Oh, we've never met him, you know." Now, I have a great respect for John MacArthur and for many other fine American preachers, household names in our evangelical circles who serve similarly in mega churches. As to whether I think it's a healthy church model, I'll leave you to guess on that one. But my question this evening is this: is God's relationship with you, is God's relationship with me, like the mega church pastor's relationship with Joe Bloggs, who happens to sit on row Z of the amphitheatre every Sunday morning listening to him preach? Is it that distant? Is it that impersonal? Is it that remote? Is it that we look up to God and we centre our lives around him while he himself has barely even heard of us? Is that how the Christian life works? Well, Psalm 23 is very much answering that question. And the answer it gives is an emphatic no. God's relationship with you and God's relationship with me, if we are his this evening, if we are reconciled to him through the blood of his Son, God's relationship to you and to me is intensely personal, deeply intimate, mind-blowingly warm. In the words of Jeff Thomas, it's not simply that this universe is loved by its maker, nor that he loves the human race, but me. He longs for my fellowship. He is involved with me. It is not a vague and general love of which I happen to be another beneficiary. It is very particular and personal love. It is almost minute in its detailed care. This God who comes so close to me, we stand before him, not as a blob, not a vague, undifferentiated mass of men and women, but as those whose names have been graven upon his heart for all eternity. And that, I'm saying, is the message really of Psalm 23. And it's brought out then, it's communicated this message here by way of two images. The divine shepherd in verses 1 to 4 and the divine host in verses 5 and 6. And so all I want to do then in the remainder of our time is look at each of these in turn. First of all then this evening, the divine shepherd there in verses 1 to 4. The Lord is my shepherd. Now that really is an extraordinary line, you know. Shepherds in the ancient world weren't highly regarded. In Genesis 46 verse 34, we are told that the Egyptians considered shepherds detestable. And even within Israel, something of a cultural backwater, really, until Solomon came along at least, even in Israel, shepherding was hardly a glamorous profession. You remember Jesse's dismissive words in 1 Samuel 16:11 Seven of his sons having been paraded before the prophet and not one of them anointed as Israel's next king. Well, there is still the younger one, he said, but he's tending the sheep. In the cultural context then, in which Psalm 23 was written, you didn't look up to shepherds. You looked up to soldiers. You looked up to courtiers. You looked up to those who owned large flocks of sheep. But you didn't look up to the smelly, low-salaried men who looked after them. And yet God in Psalm 23 is likened to a shepherd. And it's something you get this, isn't it, throughout the Bible. In the cultural context in which Hosea was prophesying, you didn't look up to a man who had been jilted by his wife. I mean, that wasn't an impressive figure to look up to. You looked up to an Absalom kind of figure with long flowing hair who made women swoon wherever he went. You looked up to a dashing, macho, confident, magnetic kind of guy like him. You didn't look up to a man whose wife had left him for something more exciting. That was just so pathetic, so embarrassing. And yet in that book of Hosea, God is likened to a jilted husband. In the cultural context in which Jesus was ministering, you didn't admire an elderly man running. That was a shameful spectacle. That was undignified conduct. Elderly men weren't supposed to run. Elderly men were supposed to sit in the city gates with their long robes and an air of gravity about them. They weren't supposed to run like a child. And yet, in Jesus' parable of the lost son, God is pictured as an elderly man running to greet the returning prodigal. And it's a wonderful recurring theme, this, isn't it? That the God of the Bible isn't some predictable embodiment of our own cultural prejudices. He doesn't conform to our human sensibilities. He doesn't march to the beat of our drum. That's what the pagan gods did. The pagan gods were so predictable. They were exactly as you would expect. They just completely reinforced our own ideas of power and glory and prestige and all the rest of it. But the God of the Bible, he's so different, isn't he? He's so uninventable. He's so counterintuitive. He's so different, so radically, disconcertingly, unnervingly different. The God of the Bible redefines all our notions of deity. Listen again to Jeff Thomas. "I wonder how your children view God," he asks. "What mental image they have of him." And then he says this: "God is like a young man kneeling down before a group of silent younger men, and one by one he washes their feet, getting all the donkey dung off them and drying in between their toes with his towel. That's God. God is like a man who lets a woman kneel before him and sob convulsively at his feet, because though she's done everything wrong in her life, she's been forgiven, and she dries his feet with her hair. That's God. He's like an exhausted shepherd climbing another ridge, descending another valley, going to the top of another peak in the wind and rain to find an unappreciative, resisting, mangy sheep and carrying it back home on his weary shoulders. That's God. Or he's like a husband who loves a wife who's a swinger, who fools around with other men, and yet he takes her back and he forgives her 70 times 7. That's God." And so I'm saying then that's the God, this radical biblical God that we've been presented with in Psalm 23, who likens himself to a shepherd. Those opening words of the psalm, they seem perhaps so well known, almost trite, cliched. It's a calendar text, isn't it? But I'm saying actually it's amazing. It's a bomb. It blasts through all our boring religious ideas of what God is like. All our stale, predictable notions of what the divine being is, and it brings us face to face with this God who defies all our expectations and rewrites all our scripts. This God who likens himself to a shepherd. Who would have thought a shepherd? A shepherd. God likening himself to a shepherd. But as we probe then a bit further here, what exactly can we take from this image which we are given? Well, I think there are two emphases which come to the fore in this shepherd image. And the first then is satisfaction. That's the first great emphasis here, satisfaction. Verse 2, he makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. Some of you may have come across this book by Douglas Macmillan, The Lord Our Shepherd. Douglas Macmillan, if you don't know, was a Scottish preacher of the 20th century. And he brings then to this particular book not only his usual preaching gifts, but also his personal background, his personal experience. He had been a shepherd, and it makes then for very colourful reading, and I'd recommend the book to you if you haven't read it. Now, I'm afraid I'm not Douglas Macmillan. I did do a couple of days potato riddling on a farm once as a teenager, but that's the extent of my farming experience. But even with my limited expertise in this area, I think I'm on safe ground saying that sheep don't aspire to delicacies. That sheep aren't particularly into caviar or roast guinea fowl or grilled lobster. That sheep don't fantasize about sitting in a Michelin-starred restaurant and feasting on a whole range of delicacies cooked by a top celebrity chef. No, you provide sheep with green pastures to eat from and still waters to drink from, and they desire nothing more. They are perfectly contented. They are fully satisfied. And that then is what verse 2 is getting at. It's getting at this idea of satisfaction. The shepherd who provides for his sheep green pastures and still waters is a shepherd who provides perfect satisfaction for his sheep. And it's saying then that if you're a believer, if you're a man or a woman of God, then God keeps you contented. God keeps you satisfied. This is what he is committed to doing for his people. He's committed to keeping them satisfied. Now that raises a very profound question, doesn't it? What does that entail? What does that mean in practice? What does that look like? What do we need in order to be satisfied? Is it that we need a certain amount of money, plus a certain standard of home comforts, plus a certain kind of relationship with the opposite sex? And if we add all those things up, then that's satisfaction. That's what many will tell us. That's the philosophy by which many of our fellow British human beings live by. Well, is that the case? Does that really add up? Does that equation work? Does it add up to contentedness and satisfaction? David Foster Wallace was an American novelist and academic who in 2008 committed suicide at the age of 46. And just 3 years earlier, in 2005, he gave a very fascinating and in retrospect a very poignant lecture address to a class of students who were graduating from a particular college that I can't remember the identity of just now. But in the course of this address, he said this. He said, "In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it Jesus Christ or Allah, be it Yahweh or the Wiccan Mother Goddess or the Four Noble Truths or some infrangible set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, If they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Never feel you have enough. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. Worship power. You will feel weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart. You will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out, and so on. It's true, isn't it? But if you go down that route, that these are the things we need. I just need to be cleverer. I need more power. I need more influence, more fame. I just need to be better looking, and that would give me satisfaction. If we go down that route, as he says, those things will eat us alive. But just be a relentless, ongoing quest with no end, no terminus. What then is the answer? What do we need for satisfaction? What do we need for contentment? Well, the psalmist actually gives us the answer in another psalm, Psalm 42, and verses 1 and 2, where he uses very similar imagery. It's not, it seems, the same psalmist actually, but the author uses very similar imagery to Psalm 23, only talking about deer rather than sheep. As the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. That's the answer. That's what our souls thirst for. That's what they need. That's what they really want. If you dig down deep enough, that's what they're aching for. That's what they're longing for. Our souls are longing for the God who made them and implanted those desires for himself in them. And so Psalm 23 then, verse 2, in the very pictorial language of this shepherd sheep world, is saying that for the believer in God, God isn't this remote megachurch pastor figure. No, God is this intimate person who enters into relationship with us and so invests in us, so opens himself up to us, that the very deepest longings of our souls are satisfied in him and with him. The very deepest achings of our inner beings are silenced and met in this fellowship, this communion, which he allows us into with himself. So, it's a wonderful picture, I'm saying, verse 2, of the satisfaction which God gives to those who are his, through himself, in himself. That's where it's found. But you might say, hang on a minute, what about those times when our souls get distracted? Because they do, don't they? And they start going after again the things that we used to chase after before this relationship with God started. It happens, doesn't it? Within our Christian lives, our souls can go off beam, can go off course, and start looking again for ultimate satisfaction in finite little things, trivialities. David himself experienced it, didn't he? On that night that he was walking around the rooftop of his palace and gazing upon beautiful Bathsheba and desiring that woman, he wasn't feeding his soul on the living God that night. His soul had been distracted and diverted by lesser, more finite, more limited pleasures. But you see, that's where verse 3 comes in, the first line. Well, in those instances, this shepherd has an answer for that as well. What does he do? He restores our souls. Isn't that wonderful? And even on those times when our souls stupidly, foolishly, suicidally go off after little things, God doesn't let that happen. He might let it happen for a while, but if we're his sheep, if we're truly in his flock, he'll bring us back, he'll restore our souls and get us feeding on him again. And that was David's experience in that situation, wasn't it? For some time, it seems, he went on just having forgotten God. But then the day came when God broke back into his life, sent Nathan the prophet along. Interestingly, that language, "he restores my soul," it's the same Hebrew phrase as we have back in Psalm 19 and verse 7. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving or restoring the soul. Perhaps a hint then as to how God usually does this. He restores our soul through the law of the Lord, through his word coming to us. Isn't that our experience so often? That we go for days kind of forgetting him. Weeks, months, years perhaps even, forgetting him, trying to feed our souls on silly little objects. And then we're in church one Sunday morning, and suddenly the preacher says something, and bang, we feel convicted and exposed, and we're on the road back to repentance and renewed faith and renewed feeding on the true object of our souls' desires. What a wonderful shepherd, bringing his sheep back when their souls get distracted. So satisfaction then is a main emphasis that we have here. But then the other emphasis that we have is safety. Safety. Because a shepherd's role then, it isn't static, is it? It isn't just that he kind of sits 24/7 in one field with his sheep, allowing them to graze and to drink. No, there's movements in a shepherd's role. He has to lead the sheep from place to place. And of course, that entails many dangers, because the countryside is a dangerous place. All kinds of valleys and chasms and unseen dangers. The countryside, a dangerous place for the shepherd to lead his sheep through. But the picture we have here then is of this shepherd not only then in the field providing his sheep with perfect satisfaction, but then on the journey, the dangerous journey, providing his sheep with perfect safety. And again then, to come out of the picture and to think about what this is telling us about our relationship with God, it's saying that through life then God leads us. It's not just that in some static state he satisfies our souls, but he also leads us through life from the moment we enter into that relationship with him to our last moment in this world. He leads us through life, and he does so then as this competent shepherd, this good shepherd, this wise shepherd who keeps us safe amidst the dangers of the journey. And that then is encapsulated in that phrase in verse 3, "he guides me in paths of righteousness." Now, the way it's translated, it sounds as though there's a moral connotation there, doesn't it? That he kind of guides us in paths of obedience, if you like, paths of holiness. I think it's simpler than that, actually. The Hebrew word can mean righteousness. It can also just mean right. And I think that's probably the preferable translation here. He guides me in right paths. In other words, he guides me in good paths, in safe paths. He doesn't guide me in paths where I'm going to fall off a precipice, in paths where I'm suddenly going to run into a lion or a bear. He guides me along right paths, good paths, paths that are going to safely get to the place where I'm going. And, of course, that can sometimes seem contrary to our experience, can't it? Sometimes, in this life, it doesn't feel like he's leading us in right paths. It feels like he must have taken a wrong turn. Why is this happening to me? Why has that happened to me? Why is life so difficult? The shepherd must have lost his map somewhere. Perhaps a fog has descended and he's gone the wrong way. But no, we've been assured here, this shepherd, always right paths. Even when it seems to us like this can't be part of the plan, it's a right path. That's what we've been assured. Reminds me of John Calvin. We know so much about John Calvin, but one thing that isn't often mentioned is the tragic side of John Calvin's life. He married late, and he and his wife had one child, and that child died in infancy. And we know very little of his response to that providence. He wrote hardly anything about it, just one paragraph, barely that, that we have, which is this. He said, "The Lord has certainly dealt a severe and bitter blow in the death of my infant son." But then this, "But he is himself a father and knows best what is good for his children." Amazing thing to say, isn't it? In that context. And that's what Psalm 23 is saying, that the paths are always right. He knows what is best, this shepherd. The path, wherever it leads, we can be sure it's the right path. Are you aware of that for yourself tonight? Perhaps tonight the path seems ever so wrong, ever so improbable, that this good shepherd would lead you where you are tonight. Things are so confusing. Things are so difficult for you. So much going on in your life. And we've been assured here, he guides me in right paths. The shepherd keeps us safe. And we're given then a very specific example of that, aren't we? In verse 4, "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death," even there, we've been told this is a right path. Even when I'm entering into the last moments, even there, the shepherd is keeping me safe. And it's so wonderful, isn't it, that that's the example he uses. Because if we're honest, don't we fear that experience, many of us? Perhaps we don't fear what lies beyond death. We know Christ has taken our punishment in our place. We know that there's no condemnation. But we still fear the actual experience of death. What's it going to be like in that valley? What's it going to be like actually drawing near to our final expiring moments? And what spiritual dangers might that experience contain? How might I be buffeted and harassed by the evil one at that point? I'm sure we all fear in that way at times. And we're being told here that our shepherd keeps us safe, even there. I referred earlier to this book by Douglas Macmillan, and in it he talks about his father's death. His father was a believing man, and he talks about a conversation which he had with his father just the night before his father died, in the bedroom where his father was lying. And this is what his father said to him: "For 40 years I have followed Christ, and for 40 years I have prayed for grace to live for Christ, and for 40 years I have prayed for grace to die like a Christian. I've always been afraid secretly, never admitted it, but I've always secretly been afraid that I wouldn't get grace to die. But now I see how stupid I was. God wouldn't give me grace I didn't need until I needed it. And when I need it, I have it." He knew in that moment his shepherd keeping him safe, even in the valley of the shadow of death. And so that's then the shepherd image, this wonderful God who is committed to our satisfaction, not through houses and things and possessions and money, because that wouldn't satisfy us anyway, but through intimate communion with him, and a God who is committed to our safety. He will lead us on right paths all the way to death's door. The divine shepherd, but then secondly and very briefly, the divine host. And we can be brief as we look at verses 5 and 6, because actually the emphases that we have here, I think, are exactly identical to the emphases in verses 1 to 4. I think often we approach this psalm as though there's a kind of progressive journey, a linear kind of journey from verse 1 to verse 6. But I think actually there are these two parts, verses 1 to 4 and verses 5 and 6, and they're both saying the same thing. They're parallel sections, if you like, but just using two different images, the divine shepherd and the divine host. And so again then, it's bringing out the same two emphases. First of all, satisfaction. And here then, it's not a shepherd placing his sheep in a lovely, rich meadow. Here, it's a host then. And he's loading the table for privileged guests. It's again an amazing picture, isn't it? Of God. This is the living God, the God of Sinai, the God of glory, the God who inhabits eternity. And here, if I may put it reverently, he's been pictured as a man with an apron on, going round his guests, saying, have you got enough there? Would you like some more? Would you like your glass filled again? Would you like some more food on your plate? He's again ensuring the satisfaction of his dinner guests. And again, then, it's a picture of this God committed to our satisfaction. Again, our satisfaction through relationship with him, through feeding our souls on him himself, the God who made us for himself. But not only then is there the emphasis of satisfaction, once again, there's the emphasis on safety as well. Because you'll notice then in verse 5 that there's this, just as in the first part, there's that kind of sudden jarring note sounded, the valley of the shadow of death. Here again, we have a jarring note sounded. And it's a familiar one in the Psalms, isn't it? Enemies. It's one of the most recurrent themes in the Psalms, especially the Psalms of David. This sense of being surrounded, besieged by enemies. We saw it in the last one, Psalm 22. That those raging bulls of Bashan, those roaring lions, those dogs that were surrounding him, those evil men, those enemies. And here again then, the idea is of this kind of divine host now. And it's like they're sitting there at the dinner table, and there are enemies kind of knocking at the doors and kind of banging on the windows, wanting to get in to kind of rip you away from the table and take you away, kidnap you. And yet the divine host, he doesn't allow it to happen. The enemies just carry on raging in the background while the meal goes on and on and on. But then actually there's not just enemies that are the kind of jarring note. But once again, death does implicitly rear its head in the second part of the psalm, doesn't it? In that last word, actually, forever. I would dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And that's saying to us surely that even death then cannot interfere with this meal, this fellowship, this communion that we've been brought into with God. At conversion, he has brought us into his house. And we're now having this meal with him, fellowshipping with him, communing with him, enjoying him. And yes, death is going to come along at some point, of course, but even that can't disrupt the whole thing. Forever we're going to stay in this house. Beyond death, the fellowship will continue. The relationship will continue. Beyond death. Indeed, of course, as the rest of Scripture will make clear, it'll get even better. It'll get even finer and even richer. This safety that we have in the house of this host. Enemies can't get us. Death can't get us. We're safe with him. And so those then are the two images of Psalm 23, the shepherd and the host. And those are the two great emphases. These are our two great privileges tonight as believers in God. We don't have a God who is distant and far off, who has made us Christians and then kind of turns his back on us and wanders off and leaves us to fend for ourselves. We have this God committed to satisfying our souls with the richest fare, and this God committed to keeping us safe. Safe all the way until that day when finally he welcomes us into heaven itself. Let's bask tonight in the wonder of it all. Amen.